If I now did a swept impedance measurement, if I had a good vector voltage network analyzer, and I did a sweeping performance measurement and so-called S11 measurement of your 120-volt circuit, it would be a complicated graph on a Smith chart. It would be a bunch of circles around the center of the Smith chart, if the center happened to be 2/10 of an ohm, if you know what I mean, and reality is going to be off to one side. The answer ain't simple. Unless you have something like that little black box I described before, let me drop. Unless you have that impedance stabilizing or impedance normalizing network mounted very close to the device under test, your transmitter, which then gives you a defined impedance looking from the transmitter back toward the Con Ed circuit, but it's going through your black box. Unless you've got that black box there, you're going to have a very complicated impedance versus frequency curve. It ain't simple. And therefore, if you did a test in your laboratory of how much radiated signal comes out of that transmitter by way of undesired transmission from the 120-volt line, you do that measurement in your shack, and you find out the undesired signal is 55 dB down, and you take that exact same transmitter with that exact same line cord, and you bring it over to my shack, and you plug it in, and I do the measurement. Instead of the 55 dB down, I'm going to measure 61 dB down. And you go over to somebody else's, you're going to measure 47 dB down because of the difference of the wiring itself. No two houses are wired the same. And you can see there's a lot of variables involved here, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
N2XJN. First, a few words about that beautiful device that I was mentioning to, listening, line impedance stabilization network. And I would say the major application for it is to block the frequencies that are being implemented to the power line by whoever. Starting from the power companies and using transceivers or the transmitters and the receivers for their purpose to X10 devices, if you heard about them, let me drop. Which is mostly home automation devices, to the spies of government agents trying to spy on you with a similar matter. And so such device would actually make impossible for the for all of these frequencies to pass, which some of the power companies would not be happy about, as they could not monitor variable data. As far as the power line impedance, if the power line voltage range is hard to specify, I would say the source impedance is even harder. And power lines usually I see as long transmission lines through the 60 hertz with the wavelengths of 5 megameters halfway from the equator to either pole. And transmission line effects result from the higher frequencies conducted onto the line from the switching loads. Above 1 megahertz, the typical power line has characteristic impedance of 50 ohm. And I have a question, because that could be not really 50 ohms, could be 300 ohms. There are two standards, or as low as 10 ohms below 1 megahertz. And then it rolls off 20 dB decade until it reaches DC resistance value. If matching the impedance is so important, and sometimes not matching to the impedance creates spikes and the danger, why then there is no standard for the impedance for the power lines? And to
yeah, nobody measures in the real world impedance of a power line versus frequency. At least Con Ed or LIPA or New Jersey Power and Light, they're not going to guarantee the impedance of your power line from 60 hertz up to, let me pick a number, 30 megacycles. They're not going to do that. On top of that, the power lines that come into your house to feed your equipment is not an impedance-matched network. In the ideal world, ConEd would look like a micro-ohm impedance. Therefore, as you draw current on that line, hopefully the voltage changes very, very little. That's not an impedance match. They're a micro-ohm, and you might be 100 ohms in the case of a 1,000-watt light bulb. Let me think now. That would be 120 volts for a 100-watt light bulb, 120 ohms. So your circuits are tens and hundreds of ohms of resistive impedance at 60 cycles, and they are micro-ohms in the ideal world, far from an impedance match. On top of that, another crazy thing that happens, even in our radio circuits, where you and I might use a piece of RG8 coaxial cable, and because we know the exact inner diameter, the exact outer diameter of the cable, we know the dielectric material in between, and you put that, plug that into the formula and say, yes, it is a 50-ohm characteristic impedance cable. And then you start sweeping the cable to lower and lower frequencies. You would assume that the cable is going to stay 50 ohms. It does not. It starts climbing toward 1,000 ohms as you go low enough in frequency. And you say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? And what's going on is that the skin depth of the outer conductor starts becoming, at low enough frequencies, the skin depth happens to become the thickness of the outer conductor, and you're picking up a reactance there. In other words, the amount of shielding. You take coaxial cable at 60 cycles. You use coaxial cable at 60 cycles and run it near a power transformer that has a lot of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You take your 60 cycle magnetic transformer, the power transformer that's in your rig, and let's assume now that it wasn't designed very well, so there's a lot of leaking magnetic field coming out of there, and you must run some wiring nearby, and you want to make sure it doesn't pick up any 60 cycles, so you run a shielded coaxial cable from point A to point B, and the cable lies near the transformer. At the RF frequencies, the coaxial cable, if it's a double shielded RG214, might have 90 decibels of shielding at, let me pick a number, 30 megacycles. You go down to 60 hertz, and you'll find out the amount of shielding of that cable is not 90 dB, it might be 9 dB. That 60 cycles walks right through the shielding of that cable because of the skin depth phenomena at that lower frequency. It's not a shield anymore. You take a ratty old twisted pair, and it might be at 60 cycles, giving you shielding of 60 dB, and your high-quality, double-shielded, silver-plated piece of RG214 cable only has 9 dB of shielding. You'll say, what in the world is going on? There's another bad kind of physics going on. Let me warn you about one other thing. If you calculate the wavelength of 60 hertz, you'll come up with a great big number. That's not what's going on in this case. The impedance between you and Consolidate Edison, I'm going to guess that 90% of that impedance is due to the way your house is wired and the way your circuit panel is wired back to that pole pig transformer on top of that utility pole out in front of your house. That's where 90% of the impedance is coming from. That transformer is a great big beefy thing, stepping 13.5 kilovolts down to 240 with center tap, and he is a very low impedance at 60 hertz. And because of that great big chunk of iron and wire...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because that transformer has got a whole lot of transformer oil, it's got great big fat laminations inside, big fat wires and so on, inside of a shielded cabinet, that thing doesn't pass very much of the 3.5 megacycles or 30 megacycles that your poorly designed transmitter tries to feed back on that line. So I am guessing that 90% of the impedance that you're going to see if you do a swept impedance of your power line is really the wiring in your house back to that transformer. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, but I think it might be close to the truth, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. I'm a little bit confused with the outlook of this conversation, because we've been taught that the impedance matching is absolutely essential, and then at low frequencies it's not so. Although a line line insertion standardization network, LISN, is a power line buffer that presents the load at control impedance for the test purposes. And it usually consists of the power filter that presents the controlled impedance to the device under test. Of course, we could alternatively use the high quality UPS, not only that will provide the controlled impedance, but also to regulate the input voltage to the nominal value. But because the UPSs are in high volume production, they are lower in cost than whatever the devices I called the LISN, and could be cost effective alternative for that. That's one of the ways of measuring it. And if that was not important to know what is the impedance match, then people wouldn't buy it. I spoke to John about it. John said, well, why should I even buy it? And then I took a close look. One of the methods in impedance measurement were the 60 Hz commercial AC power sources through the LF-HF frequency spectrum is compared to the impedance presented by the typical line impedance stabilization network. That's what we spoke about, and that's why purposely I included that in that email. Another method is the AC power resistance and the inductance through the process of measuring the real-time reaction on the line to the controlled application or of two inductors through a process of measuring the of two known impedances. Right. So it would be the real-time reaction of the line control application to compared to the two known impedances. And this method will be measuring power line impedances as high as 84 kiloamps and 480 volts for the purpose mostly of motor controls. Also, when we go to the impedance matching, and I'm still under the impression of why should I bother, if we take a very simple a task, we have a coil, let's say the rotor, and it's a 200 turn coil that has area of 4 square centimeters and rotates in magnetic field, say, put up 0.5 Tesla, and the frequency generated at maximum of, let's say, 110 volts, then the frequency would be 60 hertz, and the question would be, what is the maximum EMF that would be produced by that? Or what magnetic field must the coil be rotating to generate maximum of EMF at 110 volts at 60 hertz? So there is a real application, and it is directly related to the impedance. So why nobody bothers? I don't know.
I'm going to give you one more concept on this one, Wes, that maybe will help. Everyone thinks that impedance matching is ideal. In the radio world, that is partially true. In the power world, it is very untrue. And let me show you why. Assume now I've got an ideal black box signal generator that generates 120 volts at 60 cycles. And assume now that I decide that the ideal way to design that signal generator so that it presents exactly 50 ohms output impedance at 60 hertz. And I'm going to put it into a 50 ohm load at 60 hertz for this particular example. And I want 100 watts output, so 120 watts output. So it's going to deliver 1 ampere at 120 volts into my load. If the Thevenin impedance, the equivalent series impedance inside that black box is 50 ohms, and my load is 50 ohms, everybody in the world would say that is an impedance matched situation. We all forget about what happens with ideal impedance matching. By definition, when it's delivering 100 watts to the load on the outside of the box, it must dissipate exactly 100 watts inside. If it really is a 50-ohm impedance single generator. Half the power is dissipated in the generator. Half the power is dissipated in the load with perfect impedance matching. That's physics. If my Con Ed supplier is going to give me a, let me pick a number, a 10,000-watt volt-ampere circuit, 10,000-watt capability, and I'm going to be running rotary machinery in my shop that consumes 10,000 watts, and if in the process of doing that, Con Ed is dissipating 10,000 watts in their machinery, you can see how unhappy...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You can see how unhappy Con Ed would be in that situation. As such, you do it the other way around. Con Ed does the best they can do to make their impedance a micro-ohm, not 50 ohms, even though I'm putting 50-ohm resistance light bulbs in my circuit. The good news about that is now, as I turn on and off light bulbs in my house, the voltage moves very little. In the case of a pure 50-ohm signal generator, going into a 50-ohm loaded light bulb, we'll say, if I plug on another light bulb so that my 50 ohms goes down to 25 ohms, the voltage would change a whole lot. So there's a lot of cases in the world where you do not impedance match. And by the way, that transmitter that you and I use with the Class C output stage, which tends to run not 50% efficiency is what it would do if it was Class A. A good Class C stage can run something like 70% efficiency. And some of the Class D, E, and F transistorized stages can run closer to 90% efficiency. You don't impedance match it, even though you think you do. The manufacturer tells you it will give you rated performance if you put a 50-ohm resistive load on it. But if you use perfect laboratory instrumentation and you look back into that transmitter, you will not see 50 ohms. You'll probably see something closer to 1,000 ohms. It's a constant current generator. It's almost an open circuit. So if you performance match it to 50 ohms, you're not impedance matching. It gives rated performance at 50 ohms, but it's not a 50 ohm source. Complicated circuit, I know. I've got to go on this one, Wes. Next guy on the list was Jim, KD2BHY. Interesting for you to know, Jim, that my grandfather used to have a... Jim lives in Port Washington. My grandfather used to have a great big farm on top of a hill in Port Washington. And boy, did he used to get struck with lightning all the time. His bar...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Dick, just one quick question. What is the difference between the transformer one-to-one that has a primary 10,000 winds and a secondary 10,000 winds, and the same transformer one-to-one that has 100 winds and a secondary 100 winds? Just the answer to that question.
I cannot answer that question the way it was asked, Wes. And it would take another 10 minutes to explain that. I've got to go on. We'll come back to that one. You're on another subject, even though it sounds like it's related. So as I was telling you, Jim, my grandfather, with his farm in Port Washington on top of the hill, every time a thunderstorm came along, one of his barns used to get struck. And my grandmother used to develop an awful lot of fear of lightning because of that. Hopefully you're not living... Your house was not constructed on that farmland, Jim. KD2PHY, K2RIW. You got it, Jim.
I hope not. We're on a little bit of a hill here, but not a really big hill. That's cool. You used to live in Port Washington. Do you know what area?
With some research on my part, I probably can find out, Jim, but right now I don't know. You got it, Jim, and go ahead with your question. Any luck on finding those crystals you're looking for? I know that you've now got some understanding of that output circuit on the schematic diagram, and I know that various people were starting to promise you volt-ohm millimeters, which I'm guessing haven't been delivered yet, but hang in there, you're eventually going to get one. Over to you, Jim, K2RIW.
I've been having a lot of fun with this circuit, but I was telling you about that AM radio, and it looked really promising for the variable capacitor, but the knob that changed the dial was, it's kind of hard to explain. It was, there was a steel rod, or a metal rod, and then it just kind of ended. The metal rod just kind of went into the circuit board, and then it kind of ended, and there was nothing really on it.
Jim, if you mail me a photograph of the device you're just trying to describe, I think that would help. Back to you, Jim. Wait for the beeps.
Yes, that would definitely help. I'll try to email it to you by tonight.
Very good. I'm not positive that I'll get a chance to look at it during the TechNet tonight, but maybe I will. We'll find out how light the load is. If I know John, though, he's got quite a few things to discuss, and also the breakthrough, the so-called breakthrough that John and I made this week that I'm going to tell you guys about is another thing that's going to be a healthy 10 or 15-minute discussion. So I think you're saying you're not sure whether or not that AM transistor radio you took apart, which you hope that so-called pattern capacitor or air variable capacitor really is 365, and I guess at this time you're not sure, but there's various ways you can do an electronic measurement of that capacitor to find out is it in the ballpark of 365. I mean, if it's between 300 and 400, close enough, if you know what I mean. So right now I think you're not sure what is the value, you're not sure what you're looking at, and you're not quite sure how to measure it. I'm making some guesses there, Jim. Back to you for some corrections. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the tech man.
Kind of puzzling. It's really strange. I mean, it doesn't look like there's a component at the end. It just kind of looks like a steel rod, and then there's a little bit of a swivel, and it really doesn't look like there's anything on the end. It's kind of confusing, but I just had a quick question about my transmitter. I've been looking at some pictures of the air variable capacitors. How do I attach that to the breadboard? It looks kind of confusing.
If this is the best of all worlds, the leads coming out of your variable capacitor will plug directly into some holes of, you know, plated through holes that you've got on the printed circuit board. However, at 7 megacycles, the good news, Jim, is you can get away with murder. I mean, in the ideal physical layout, the particular air variable 365 picofarad capacitor you've got was made for that exact printed circuit board. It's got two prongs coming out of it, which are the two ends of the capacitor. They plug directly into the board, and you solder it down. That's the real world. That's the ideal world. Let's get real. Your particular capacitor you're picking up out of an AM radio was never intended for that particular printed circuit board. But the nice thing about 7 megacycles is that the wavelength is, I think the wavelength is 132 feet. You could therefore, if you desire, take that air variable capacitor, put it 3 inches over to one side, run ordinary pushback wire between the two terminals of the air variable capacitor, snake them around almost any way you want, and plug them into those particular holes on the printed circuit board. Physically, radio-wise, you would think it would be ugly, but now think about the way that radio wave behaves. If that radio wave is operating on a wavelength of 132 feet, where a half-wave dipole is going to be 67 feet long, and you've got 3 or 4 inches of wire, which is not even 1 degree of phase angle at a 360 degrees for a wavelength, your little bit of wiring will have absolutely no disturbance of the circuit. You can wire that as a, what's the word I'm looking for? A rat's nest wiring. And you'd be amazed what you can get away with at 7 megacycles. You do that at 7,000 megacycles, 7 gigahertz, oh, hell break loose. But at 7 megacycles, you can get away with murder, Jim. I can remember the first time I built, let me drop it. My first 6-meter transmitter, 150 megacycle transmitter, running with a 4CX250B2, running at the 300-watt level at 50 megacycles, I needed a good transmit-receive relay, coaxial relay. I'm a poor guy, 16 years old, just beyond the point where I was getting my money from a paper route. I had no real money, had no real access to people. There was no TechNet in those days. I picked up a 60-cycle rated relay. The relay was rated at 60 cycles, rated for power circuits. It was rated for something like 5 amperes on its contacts. But it was in a metal can, and I just ran wires over to the leads of the relay contact on this metal can and used it as the transmit-receive relay at 50 megacycles. It worked like a charm. So when you're down at frequencies like 7 megs, you can get away with murder, Jim. Exact layout is not required. As long as point A connects to point B, so to speak, through your wiring that you're going to add, it's going to fly. And if it doesn't, it's not going to burn up, it's not going to explode. If it gives you a little bit of a strange performance, you'll make the measurements, we'll find out what it is, and we'll correct it. It's an educational process. KD2BHY, you don't have to worry. KQRAW, go ahead, Jim.
Sure, it's helpful. Yeah, because I was just confused because I'm doing this on a breadboard from the circuit off the internet, and I was just kind of confused how you attached that, and I really explained. That was really a good explanation. Also, I have one more quick question. I have this 10-meter radio that was given to me from a ham that I met on the KQ2H repeater, and it's a really nice radio, and it's an HR2510, and I don't have an antenna for it, and I was wondering if I could... I tried to build the 10-meter dipole, but that ended poorly.
Another good piece of news for you, Jim. Let's assume now that you've got sitting on your table a multiband radio that's rated for 80 through 10 meters. And in the ideal world, you'd like to have a fan dipole out there on a nice high tree in your backyard where each one of those dipoles in the fan, there's one dipole for 80, one dipole for 40, one dipole for 20, and so on. That's the ideal world. When you're using the radio in the receive mode, not transmitting, but in the receive mode, you pick up any old random hunk of wire you've got. Maybe the piece of wire is 4 feet long. You take the one end of the wire, which has got rubber insulation on it, or plastic insulation, and you skin the wire back about a half an inch, and you take that piece of wire and you fold it back on itself so that it acts like the center pin of a PL-259 center pin. And you plug that into the center pin of the back of the radio. Don't even have a shield, don't have a coax cable, don't have a dipole. You just got this 4 foot long piece of wire laying on the wooden table on the back of the radio. And you start tuning across the ham bands. Every one of those ham bands will sound beautiful. You'll say, what in the world is going on? It works like a charm. I can't transmit into it, but it will receive. And when you do some careful measurements, you'll find out that if you had the reel, let me drop. If the 20 meter band is open, and you had the real fan dipole connected, and that particular signal you're listening to from that guy that's transmitting from Chicago comes into your fan dipole and gives you a 10 dB over S9 signal strength on the field strength meter, but instead of that real fan dipole, you've got this little 4 foot length of wire connected to the radio, and what comes out of the loudspeaker sounds perfect, except that it only registers S5 on the signal strength meter. So that random hunk of wire is not going to give you as strong a signal, but because the amount of noise Mother Nature gives you in the background, with that real fan dipole, your noise level in your particular Port Washington QTH might be S3. And with your little piece of wire, it's going to be S1. Because the noise goes down with a small wire antenna, and the signal goes down, but the signal and noise go down by the same ratio, except for the smaller S meter deflection, it's going to sound beautiful. A receiver is extremely forgiving on HF signals, on HF frequencies. So connect any old piece of wire you've got. Do some experiments with long ones and short ones if you want to. But you'd be amazed if the radio is really working. It'll work on the yuckiest antenna in the world. Give it a try. KD2BHY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
I've done that before, and it's really a lot of fun. I did it during the... when I didn't have an antenna for my HF radio that I got from Hal, when I didn't have an antenna for that, I just plugged in, it was about 6 feet long, and it was just wire I found on the ground, and it really worked, and I heard most of the colonies in this, there were these special event stations, and there was one for each colony.
Yeah, you make a careful measurement of your piece of wire at that frequency, and you may find out, as an antenna, it has a, let me pick a number, a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio, when you would like the standing wave ratio to be under 1.6 to 1, if you know what I mean. But a receiver is amazingly forgiving because of a bunch of crazy things that happen at HF frequencies. Now, you're not going to get that kind of performance if you did the experiment on 2 meters. But on 80 through 10 meters, you can get away with murder, and a random hunk of wire will do that for you, Jim. So, you can test test out somebody's receiver. I mean, if there's a source of power and you're at a flea market and the guy's got the receiver sitting on the bench and you want to know, is it working? And you don't have the real 40-meter antenna to connect to it, but you've got a piece of wire you can connect, or he's got a piece of wire, you can confirm that it's operational before you buy it. Any other questions, Jim? KD2BHY, K2LAW.
Yeah, just some, what simple 10-meter antennas are there out there that I could build? Because I don't really have a lot of here, so what simple antennas I could build? I have some coax with one of the ends snipped off laying around here, and what simple 10-meter antenna that I could transmit out of could I build? I tried a dipole once, but that didn't end well.
Do we have a suggestion, Dick? I'm going to pick up Rich in a second. In my opinion, the simplest, most reliable, low-cost dipole on 10 meters would be roughly 16 feet long. 8 feet to the right, 8 feet to the left. Center conductor connected to one side, shield connected to the other side. Be nice to put a balancing device there. It's not mandatory, but it would be nice. And if you've got enough coax cable lift over, you can make a poor man's balance by taking a few turns of the coax right at the antenna and wrapping it together with black tape as a kind of an RF choke. That's a poor man's balance. The dipole itself on 10 meters to get reasonable performance, it'd be nice for it to be at least 10 or 15 feet in the air. The higher, the better. And if the 10-meter band is not open, you'll think the band is dead. And when the band does open, it'll have all kinds of activity. And 10 meters is a band that doesn't open all the time unless you've got, let me drop. Unless you get the right amount of activity in the sunspot cycle on that particular day and the right hour of the day. So if the radio really does have reasonable performance on 10 meters, a half-wave dipole roughly 16 feet long and 10 meters has to fly at a reasonable altitude. But it'll seem like nothing's happening if the band is not open. There are very few antennas you can build. And by the way, that dipole, that 16-foot long, 80-meter, 30-meter dipole, here we go, 30-megacycle dipole, 10-meter dipole, really 28 megs, but you know what I mean. The insulators, in the ideal world, it would be nice if it's a real piece of porcelain insulator in the center, and the same thing on the two ends. Well, the rope that's suspending the two ends doesn't need an insulator. And the insulator in the center can be a radial piece of plexiglass that you drilled a couple of holes in, if you know what I mean. Nothing really magic there. Because the wavelength is 32 feet long, and you're playing around with a center insulator on your piece of plexiglass that's an inch or two between the two holes, the exact spacing doesn't matter. Again, once you look at the wavelengths correctly, you can get away with murder on this one, Jim. Rich, N2EO, if you were putting up an inexpensive, simple antenna on 10 meters, how would you do it? N2EO, K2LAW in the group.
Okay, Dick, let me go to reset. All right, N2EO, I want to leave a little voice for our Canadian friends. Dick, just a suggestion. You know, CB is kind of dead, and he might be able to get an inexpensive, or even somebody give him a CB antenna, and recut it to 10 meters, just before, Dick. And, you know, a lot of people think that, well, it's vertical, and everybody's horizontal. If he's working TX, it doesn't matter, because the signal rotates through the ionosphere with Faraday rotation. So unless he's working local stations, it doesn't much matter whether he's vertical, horizontal, or whatever. So it was just a thought. If he could find somebody maybe who has an old CB antenna, and he can cut it down with a hacksaw, a tubing cutter, anything, until he gets it to resonate on 10 meters. What do you think, Dick?
Boy, what would comment? Yeah, fairly good comment, Rich. And Joe, I'll pick you up in a second. And by measuring, if he had the ability to measure standing wave ratio versus frequency, he'd be able to find out, is it too short or too long when it comes to resonating it. And on top of that, I vaguely remember in the past, Jim, you were telling me about putting the dipole up in the most convenient place you could around your house, and portions of the dipole, I think, were laying almost parallel to the rain gutter of the house. which makes things a little bit more complicated. A dipole alongside of the rain gutter, when the band is open, will work. When the band is closed, the dipole high in a tree all by itself in an ideal environment will give you very few signals to listen to. The 10-meter band, among other HF bands, but 10 meters in particular, when that band closes, Jim, it's like somebody really slams the door. There's nothing coming through except the guy that's a mile away from you. And when the band is open, you're going to be hearing guys from 1,000 miles away like they're in your backyard. That ionosphere, when the signal bounces off the ionosphere on 28 megacycles, the signal off the ionosphere would be, let me pick a number, 90 decibels louder than it would be if the ionosphere is not reflecting the signal. 90 decibels is a, I think it's 100 billion or 10 billion to 1 power ratio. Very, very little signal gets through on 10 meters. When that door is shut on 10 meters, it's shut tight. And you'll think your receiver is dead. W2RYY, what do you suggest, Joe? K2RIW, wait for the four beeps.
Okay, a few years ago, Dick, I put up an antenna called an Antron 99. It's a fiberglass antenna. I forget the exact dimensions, but it resembles something about maybe 15 feet long. It comes in pieces. It's fairly easy to assemble. Doesn't cost a lot of money. I think I bought one new for like, I don't know, at the time, $100. But I've seen them on eBay at various prices less than that. Apparently either a new or a very, very good condition. And the funny thing about it is, the one I have, I specifically bought it for use on 10 meters. I tuned it right on the nose at 29 megahertz with a return loss bridge. And it's pretty easy to tune with the tuning rings that are involved that resemble a pair of tuning nuts. But the odd thing I found about it is I thought I'd have a fairly tight bandwidth where once I walked away from 10 meters, it would go crazy and I'd never be able to use it. Without the antenna tuner in my PS690, I can still use it reasonably down to 18 megahertz, and it exhibits 3-to-1 SPDR at 18 megahertz, and it goes to about maybe 2.5-to-1 at 21 megahertz, and it gets a little better when it gets up to 24 megahertz, and of course it's much, much better throughout the entire 10-meter band. But with the antenna tuner I have, I'm able to resolve it, and actually make the antenna makes some pretty good contacts. I've talked to Europe this morning, talked to last Sunday morning, and made contacts on 15 meters and 12 meters. The antenna works very well, and it might give the guy a chance to, you know, open up and use some other bands just besides 10 meters. And of course, it works best on 10 meters. That's where I tuned it a little bit. If you want something that works pretty fairly broad for a vertical antenna, might be the way to go. In fact, that might be a subject I'd like to bring up next week as far as the innards of the thing, if anyone knows anything about it, why the antenna exhibits that kind of wide bandwidth on HF. Back to you.
Now, you're using that antenna at a very wide bandwidth because you've got a pretty stealthy broadband antenna tuner. I don't think Jim owns an antenna tuner yet. And the antenna itself that you're describing, Joe, that particular antenna, what's the method by which Jim could get that antenna? How much does it cost? I mean, is somebody throwing one of those away and he can get it for free? Or if he has to buy it with real money, roughly how many dollars is it going to cost? Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
As I said, I paid about $100 for it. I bought it many, many years ago at a local electronics shop, which is now closed, as they dry up on the island. But if you simply type Antron 99 on a site like eBay, you can find loads of them on there. You can find some even with the ground plane radio kit, which is an add-on kit that comes with it. And the prices are not too terribly bad. The figures I'm giving as far as SWR, that was measured with the TS690 without the antenna tuner being energized. That's from the radio itself without the antenna tuner actually being utilized. And as I said, when this thing goes down to about 18 meg, 18.5, and it gives you, I see an SWR of 3-to-1, which is not very surprising because it was tuned to be extremely good at 29 megahertz even. So for it to go that low, it's kind of weird that it gives you that kind of bandwidth. It works okay on 20 with the antenna tuner that's built in the radio, but the return loss on the VSWR at 14 megahertz is very, very high. It's extremely high. I don't usually use the thing down that low because I don't want to burn up the antenna tuner on the radio. I know it has a certain ratio it can handle. but something that might give the guy something where he can use working on 10 meters, 15 meters, 12 meters, maybe down to 17 meters might be a good way to do it. So they are used. I've seen new ones and used ones on eBay for $100 and less.
Okay, as soon as Jim has a great big pile of money sitting alongside of his tuna fish can transmitter on 40 meters, he consider buying one of those. I'm joking with you a little bit here, Joe. And the dipole itself that I think you're going to be constructing on 10 meters, Jim, the diameter of the wire you use almost doesn't matter. It's only for physical strength. If you've got some 26-gauge enameled wire sitting around the house, or wire that used to be part of Category 5 computer cabling, and you strip away the rubber insulation, you get the individual leads. Any of those wires will work. I mean, the average guy thinks it's got to be real antenna wire. It's got to be real 16-gauge stranded copper wire with real ceramic insulators, or else it's not a dipole. Where you thought your dipole on 10 meters wasn't working because it was close to the rain gutter, I don't think that was it. As long as it really had the coax cable connecting to the wires with a reasonable solder contact, really making electrical contact, and the antenna had a little bit of altitude, and if the band was open, you would have heard signals. KD2BHY, K2LAW, go ahead, Jim.
KC2MDP.
Jim first, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I don't think the gutter was the problem. I think it's the way I soldered it in the middle, because I've tried to build a couple of dipoles, but they all, I mean, none of them worked. And I did the SWR measurements, and they're always, I mean, through the roof. I think it's the way that I connected it in the middle. I stripped off the insulator to the coax. I took the braiding and I soldered it to one end, and I took off that waxy part, and then I soldered the center conductor to the other end.
And if you have any doubt about whether or not you're making good electrical contact, Jim, your ohm meter should be able to confirm that for you. And if you don't have an ohm meter, you can build a light bulb circuit, if you know what I mean, a battery and a light bulb. But when you test the center conductor at the shack end of the coax cable, and you touch by scraping away the enamel insulation on the dipole wire itself, if you have to, and you confirm you're making contact to one side and not to the other side, which means it's got a short circuit, and then you connect from the shield in the shack to the other side of the dipole, your ohm meter will tell you you've got contact. And then another test would be in the shack to go from center conductor to shield to make sure there is no short circuit. You should have an open circuit between the two leads in the shack and be able to confirm the contact to each half of the dipole. So if you're a little worried about whether or not your coax, whether or not your solder joint made it, your ohm meter can confirm that for you. Let's see what Steve's got to say. KC2MDP, K2RAW, go ahead, Steve. I thought I heard KC2MDP. Now, one more call. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, Dick, I was just waiting for it to drop. If he's interested, I do have a 10-meter vertical antenna. It's fiberglass. It was originally a CB antenna, but it does have these tuning rings on it that you can adjust it for 10 meters. It's several years old, but it's practically brand new. It was never put up. It's been sitting in the garage for years and years. If he wants it, he's more than welcome to it. You know, he can have it for nothing. You know, if he wants to contact me, he can contact me, you know, with my call at optonline.net, the ARRL website doesn't seem to be forwarding my email. So it's my call, KC2MDP at optonline, which is optonline.net, and we can set up a meeting. I could drive out there, or we could meet halfway, something like that. You know, it's up to him. Back to you, Dick.
Well done, Steve. That's an attractive offer. Steve is in Baldwin. Jim is in Port Washington. Those are both Nassau County towns. To me, who lives in Suffolk County, I think that they're alongside of each other. Obviously, one's on the South Shore, one's on the North Shore. But by one means or another, you guys got to get together. Sounds like the price is right, Jim. So I wonder if you need a fill on any of the information on this free antenna. That's the right price. Back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LAW.
Thank you so much, Steve. This is really helpful, and really thank you for this antenna. And if you could just repeat your email address one more time.
You got it, Steve.
Okay, it's KC2MDP at OptOnline. That's OptOnline.net. Yeah, just drop me an email. You know, let me know when's a good time for you. You know, if you want me to drive out to your house, you know, you can give me the address. We can meet halfway. And I'll leave it up to you. Back to you.
Sure, sounds good. I just want a correction. Is it MD? Is it MD? Papa or MD Bravo?
That's Mike Delta Papa.
Thank you so much, Steve.
No problem. Glad to help you out.
Good luck with that project. And next week, you guys will get back and tell us whether or not that exchange took place. Okay, the next person on the list was Scott. Victor Echo 3, Zebra Tango Zebra. I hope we were leaving enough spaces for you, Scott. You've got it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening to all. This is Scott in Toronto, Canada, V3, ZTZ. Yes, gentlemen, you are leaving more than enough space. You did a great job last weekend, and you're doing a fantastic job this weekend. Very much appreciated. One comment and one comment with question, if I may, following up from last week on sort of the wrongful criticism of the power company. I'm just going to drop. There was a debate about how the power company can spend its resources, whether it, you know, sends troops out to figure out who's up and who's down, or whether it sends troops out and fixes what they find is broke as they find it. Up here, the province has mandated smart meters be sort of evergreened into the new homes and retrofitted onto old ones and whatnot. And those smart meters not only do peak and off-peak rates, but they're also RF-chipped, and they're part of the cellular data network. And one of the utilities in emergencies that that provides to the power company, providing the cellular network is up, is that they can pull neighborhood by neighborhood all the smart meters and find out which meters are responding. Or neighborhoods where the meters are responding and neighborhoods where the meters are not, and then know where they have to dispatch their crews. And up here where we've had a limited number of outages due to weather and trees downing lines and stuff like that, power company is very quick to show up because they can pull the smart meters. V3ZTZ.
That's a good suggestion, Scott, for a reasonable event. If 5% of my community is without power, and by way of the smart meters talking back to me, I can find out that community A, community B, and community Z doesn't have power, I know where to send the repair crew. During Superstorm Sandy, 90% of Long Island was without power. 90%. In other words, all of the smart meters would tell you everything is dead. No power anywhere, per se. And what you, as the power company, want to know is, okay, this major community of Huntington, with its major hospital, has no power. Do they have no power because four or five telephone poles are laying flat on the ground? Do they have no power because four or five of the wires have been ripped out, but the telephone poles are standing? Is the power out because there's 14 trees across that particular line, and it's going to take a huge set of resources of bringing in tree-cutting equipment just to get rid of the trees before you can start restoring the wiring. I mean, to know that the power is out, it's that massive, tells you 10% of what you want to know. The other 90% is, okay, it's out, but how? There's only 10 different ways that the power of that particular community and that particular high-priority section is out. And so Are you sending out a tree trimming crew? Are you sending out a crew that's going to be installing telephone poles? Are you sending out a crew with cherry pickers that's reestablishing the wiring? Are you sending out a crew with fancy instrumentation that's going to be probing the wiring below ground to find out what happened? Are you going to be sending out a crew with a saltwater pump to get rid of the water that's in the substations that are in the ground? So they needed a hell of a lot more knowledge than just knowing the power was out in this particular event.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
For a normal event, Scott, you're right, but not for this one. And right now, as I see it, the combination of New York, New Jersey, just those two states alone, I think are coming up with numbers like $70 or $80 billion worth of total damage to homes and infrastructure. A significant number of counties have been declared a disaster area. And if you look at our local news, maybe you're seeing portions of it there, where you look at the devastation that people are living with a month later, where they basically have a house you can't live in yet, and there's thousands of those, and 250,000 automobiles were wiped out. They're now sitting in graveyards, so to speak, and the newspaper reports are now saying you can't put those automobiles in those graveyards because as they deteriorate, they're going to be putting all kinds of exotic chemistry in the soil that's going to be damaging the water table. So there's a fair amount of grief here yet, as you can see, Scott. You guys are a lot healthier up there. DE3ZTZ, K2RIW. You got it, Scott.
You were, I just got the news, it was last weekend, one of the hour-long news channels did a thing on I believe it was Staten Island, and wow, it was certainly an eye-opener for us up here. But moving along to my second comment and a bit back to power supplies and generators and using them efficiently. Here I have mostly mobile radios and AC to DC. And because of business, I have access to PC power supplies that audited. 2007, there's a mandate that they're 80% efficient in the conversion factor, so when you're using them on generator power, they're more efficient than all the power pucks and wall warts and things like that. They also provide a 12.4 volt regulated rail, typically at 20 amps or better. They also provide 5 volts, and for $6 you can go to a PC parts store and get a 4-port USB tab that would, sort of you'd stick in the back of your PC, and you get 4 USB ports to charge all of your cell phones and iPads and pods and things like that, so that you don't have to lug all those wall warts and things around. And on mine, I additionally use the 3.3 volt regulated rail with the Cree, CREE LEDs. Soldered down to a piece of bar aluminum to do the heat dissipation, and a dropping set of dropping resistors, and that's my light bar. So one PC power supply drives 3 mobile radios, is my 5-volt cell phone and everything charger, as well as providing LED-based lighting. And I'd like to ask a question about PC power supplies, if I may. DE3ZTZ.
Yeah, this beautiful circuit that you're describing that provides all of these outlets, Scott, please tell us the brand name and the approximate number of dollars and where you buy it. Sounds awfully desirable. PE3ZTZ, K2RIW.
It's homebrewed. As I said, being in the IT industry, my IT departments and things like that throw out PCs all the time, and you just scrounge a PC power supply. There is information out there on Google and different sites and repeater builders and places like that on what all the different colored cables are out of the PC, so that you can pick off the 12, the 5, and the 3.3 volt rails. I've done it for essentially free. because I can scrounge the PC power supplies. As I said, it's a $6 part at any PC supply store to get the USB, the 4-port USB connector. I'm not sure it has a proper name other than a 4-port USB connector. The E3ZTZ.
I am slowly catching on. Fantastic. Why haven't we considered that? You're absolutely right. There's zillions of computers being thrown out all the time. To a smart ham radio operator who walks up and down the streets and looks at the garbage cans, he'll see computers being thrown away. Or he can go to places where these things are being recycled, so to speak. So the power supply out of your normal desktop computer produces all of those voltages. Plus or minus 15, plus or minus 12, plus 5, plus 3. And so with the right kind of interconnects, that one power supply plugged into a generator, for instance, allows you to run a hell of a lot of other chargers once you establish the right kind of connectors. A smart guy can take that, put it into a nice plastic box, put the right kind of connectors on the outside, and now in an emergency he can feed a lot of things. Wow. Yes. And because these things are in such huge mass production, they're made like a dime a dozen, so to speak. If you have to buy it brand new, it's not very expensive. But searching out of garbage cans, we're going to get a lot of them free of charge. In the old days, we amateurs used to get a lot of spare parts by finding people's television sets they threw away. Nowadays, we can get a lot of spare parts by finding people's computers they throw away. And that power supply is a beauty. Well done, Scott. I'm surprised we haven't thought of that. And we thought we were crafty. VE3ZTZ, go ahead with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2MMY.
MMY, stand by. Scott, go ahead.
Thank you, Scott, VE3ZTZ. Little bit of the background information. The ATX type power supplies that I'm referring to have generations and their versions, and they go from like one version 1.1, which are the earliest ones, up to version 2.3, which are the latest generation ones. Actually, I think there's a version 2.4 out now. But the ones you'll find in used parts stores and PC places that are being dumped are generally V2 type. Prior to the Pentium 4 generation, all the amperage, the bulk of the amperage, was on the 5-volt rail, not the 12-volt rail. And to get 13.8 volts out of a PC power supply, you can use a PC power supply one of three ways. Unmodified, take the 12.4 and just live with it. Modify it by going in and looking at the circuit board and finding the two resistors on it that constitute the voltage divider on the feedback pin of the voltage regulator. Cut out one of them, put a pot in there, and adjust it until you get as close to 13.8 as you can, which is what I've done with mine. And the third technique, which is where my question comes. I'm going to trip. You take three like models of the older generation where all the amperage is in the 5-volt rail, and you connect the 5-volt pins, rails, in series to each other. And on two of the power supplies, you disconnect the AC ground. So two of the power supplies are floating ground, and one is actually grounded AC. So now you have three 5-volt rails in series. You will get a regulated 15 volts at close to 40 amps, depending on the size of the power supplies. The three identical power supplies or near identical power supplies you've chained together. Anyone on net, yourself included, who's actually done this, I have not tried this free technique that I've found on the internet, but I'm curious to give it a go. D3ZTZ.
There's a guy down here on Long Island who did something similar. He needed something like 35 or 40 amperes at 12 or 14 volts, as I remember. And he saw being very inexpensively sold 5 ampere power supplies rated for 40 amps each. And each one of them was like $5 or $10. And he bought three of them. And in the case of that particular power supply that he bought, the 5-volt output was thoroughly floating. transformer isolated, plus and minus lead was thoroughly floated. Nothing was grounded to the case. He simply put the 3 in series, and he had 15 volts at 40 amperes for a very inexpensive price, very well regulated. So when you've got a thoroughly floating